You are listening to the Vital MX Post-Race Show, presented by Decal Works.
2024 Monster Energy Supercross is rapidly racing towards a conclusion now. Just two rounds remain after round 15 of the 2024 series in Philadelphia, Lincoln Financial Field, a new stop on the schedule. Of course, Philadelphia did appear in 1980, but come on. That's hardly relevant at this point. We will get into everything that happened at round 15 on this episode of the Vital MX post-race show. First of all, I would, of course, like to thank Decal Works for their continued support and dedication to this podcast. It truly would not be possible without them. So I strongly urge you to head over to their website or social media to see what their offering is, because there will be so much for you to dive into. And their website is, of course, decalmx.com. Very easy for you to remember. And hey, have this podcast playing in the background? Scroll through their website whilst you're listening. Best of both worlds. I'm your host, Lewis Phillips, joined by Michael Lindsay as per. Hello.
Hello, hello, hello.
Philadelphia was a tale of two emotions, really, because genuinely, this will sound crazy, I'm open to having a discussion about the 250 race being the best race of the year, full stop.
Ooh, I would agree. Like, in the sense of just storylines, what happened at the front between Seth and Max, watching Tom and Hayden come through the pack, and then the middle dice, you know, that came up between Seth and Swole. Like, there was just so much going on at all times. It was definitely a race. I'm bummed that I wasn't there in the press box, because, you know, on TV, they were doing a lot of split screen, but there were still times where I was like, I want to know what's going on here, and I'm trying to watch live timing at the same time, because there was just so much going on everywhere, which, again, I kept saying this last week, and I was hoping we get that for, you know, it's not trending the way I was hoping, but that's why I was so interested in the final shootout of the year, because I'm like, oh, there'll be like three or four storylines through the field.
And on the flip side, the other emotion, the 450 race was arguably the worst race of the year, which
it was up there.
You would not have wished you were in the press box for. And basically everything you said about the 250 race, the opposite is true for the 450 race. Don't really know how I feel about Philadelphia. I did feel as though it was a very impressive venue. The stadium was cool. I mean, to a degree, every stadium is the same, but it had some sort of a wow factor. Like, it was big, good crowd, I felt, considering how... Actually, let me see how many people it seats, because there were some empty areas as per, but it's so big. 67,000. So yeah, I would say that was a crowd in the 40s, 35 plus, certainly nothing to sniff at. So proves that the market in that part of the country is strong. I will be honest and transparent. I had no idea where I was.
Oh, it makes me feel so much better as the American that always says something stupid like that when I'm abroad, because I don't pay attention.
It wasn't until I landed or I was in the airport and I overheard the word Pennsylvania, and I was like, what? I'm not in Pennsylvania. And then I looked and I was indeed in Pennsylvania, which shocked me. And then someone said to me, oh, I'm staying in New Jersey. And I went, well, why the fuck are you staying there? That must be like hours away. And they were like, no, it's like 10 minutes away. And I was like, okay, I don't know where I am at all. But I did enjoy it, despite the ignorance. It sounds like this could be alternating with another venue from next year, similar to the
Austin,
East Rutherford, Boston situation.
What did we really, that's kind of anywhere near that, what did we lose off the schedule this year that we would alternate?
Well, I would enter this conversation, but as I've just proven, I am an idiot. So like, I might tell you that maybe they're going to alternate it with Anaheim, and that would obviously be ridiculous. So I'm literally looking at a map now.
Map of the USA.
Is there a stadium in... I was also surprised to learn that I was so close to Washington.
Yeah, D.C. you mean?
I met a fan, and they went, I came up from Washington, D.C., and I was like, bloody hell, that was far. And they were like, nope. And I was like, oh.
Dude, especially, you'll realize that once you get up, like, into the original 13 colonies up there, some of the states, A, are small. Like, oh, Cody's from Shock's from Delaware. Delaware to PA is, like, nothing. I heard so many writers or East Coast guys that were talking about having a lot of friends and family there. Because Philadelphia is kind of smack dab between a lot of little states up there. You're not that far from New York, Massachusetts, Connecticut, all that. You're not that far from Jersey, Delaware, Maryland, DC, not that big of a hike. You'll notice that when you go to, what's the one I'm thinking about? High Point's kind of like that. You end up with people from like four or five surrounding states because it's kind of on the corner of some states. And if you look at the map of Philly, like, it borders a lot of states with, a short region.
Well, this is where my confusion came from, because I think of Pennsylvania as High Point, and I don't look at High Point as being basically New York. So
yeah, because High Point, my
confusion enters.
Yeah, because High Point's literally the opposite, not the opposite corner, but it's the, because Philly is the southeast corner, High Point's the southwest corner, and PA is a decent sized state. But I mean, once you get that far back east, I think it would remind you more of Europe, like how close all the states are, more like countries in Europe that you've dealt with, like how when you go to a GP, probably where you catch people coming from.
Wow. I mean, I'm looking at my map. Texas is massive.
Yeah. That's why it takes a day to cross that damn state. Literally a day by itself.
Okay, this will be what I do once we finish the podcast, because this is actually quite interesting. I've never had a map with all the like state sizes on it. This is really interesting.
Oh, God. Lewis is going to learn about U.S. geography.
Oh, and there's me. Yep, there I am. Very far away from Philadelphia. Anyway,
realize that on your long-ass flights this weekend.
That discussion may be more interesting than the 450 discussion, because as mentioned, not so much happened there, although there is some bigger picture discussion to get into. But first of all, Jet Lawrence was picture perfect. And last week, the conversation was Nashville Jet Lawrence's best race of the season? I feel like we can just roll that conversation over to now, because Philadelphia may have been Jet Lawrence's best race of the season.
I feel like the stomp factor was bigger in Nashville, just the gaps. Don't get me wrong, Philly is very, very close. I lean slightly on Nashville, but both of them were just exactly what he needed to do. And I feel for Webb, like looking at Webb's frustration afterwards, like, what do you do? What do you do? You have to do, for Cooper, he has to do the most un-Cooper-like thing. He needs the whole shot and control race start to finish, which he's done this year, and that's very different for him. Because how do you beat Jet? Pray that what the heat race happens, like, damn.
Well, I'll be honest though, when like the early laps, it looked like Eli wanted some, and it looked like Cooper wanted some. Like, I was like, oh boy, Cooper is intense right now. Like, there is a lot of raw speed coming out of him. But for whatever reason, it just kind of, well, arm pump, I guess, was the reason. Yeah. But it just popped very early on.
You got to imagine if you're either of them, especially Coop, he is do or die situation. You see Jet out front and you know legitimately, as much as you believe in yourself, that he is the fastest guy in the field. What do? You can't ride comfortable. You can't. Like, you have to put out your absolute best. And it happens. You hold your breath. You don't ride comfortable. You push too hard. Like, it doesn't shock me that as soon as mid-race, I was like, yep, he's tight, and seeing the frustration afterwards, I wonder what the psyche is like. Is the frustration you got tight, the frustration you started making mistakes, or is the frustration that you threw it down and you couldn't make it happen?
Well, I wonder if the tightness came from, and this will be a paraphrase because I can't remember exactly what he said on press day, but essentially he alluded to the fact that Jet is the hardest challenge he has faced. Obviously, he has raced Eli for a championship, Kenny, Marv, Sexton last year, a lot of the greats of the last 10 years. And he kind of was quite forthright in the fact that Jet is the hardest challenge. So I wonder if in the early laps, when he's staring at the back of Jet's jersey, it's not as, well, obviously it's not relaxing for him, but I wonder if the cogs in his head are turning a little quicker than they would be in any other situation, and that's where it all falls down. Like, I wonder if he's like, right, what the fuck do I do here? I need to figure this out. Do I, blah, 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 blah. You know, like it all just happens too fast when you're staring at the number 18.
Yeah. I mean, let's just put this honest. There's still a long ways to go in Jet's career. We all know that at his current trajectory, he will be very easily one of the greats and potentially could knock on the door some of the biggest records. But I saw one this weekend. It was, your best guys in 450. It was their first 15 races of their 450 career and how many wins they got. I mean, McGrath was considered very instantly successful in the big bikes. Dungey won his first, won his first title, everything. But I mean, the wins that Jet is currently at the top of the list for most wins in first 15 races.
Well, yeah, he's on 7 now. Let's be okay. Let's do this. 2 races left. Who wins? Like, does Jet win both? Like, give me your winners across the next 2 weekends.
He definitely wins next weekend. I think he just he's so intense on the podium right now. I don't think he even gives them an inkling of opportunity if he can control it next weekend. Maybe the final round he just controls. I have a weird feeling that if he's going to stop it out, I think he's most likely to win the final 2 rounds. You know, can somebody else? Yes. But if you ask me who's going to win the last 2, I think it's going to be him.
Yes, that would be the smart bet. And if I remember correctly, he won the final round of 250s last year when he didn't need to, and there was nothing really for him to gain from doing 450s,
that. 450s, everything. Well, 450, the gain was the perfect season. Excuse me. Sorry.
But on the flip side, if I look outside of Jet, I could see Chase winning one, and I could see Eli winning one.
So you think, again, because Coop's in the most do or die situation, do you think, in a sense, the bubble has popped for Coop?
I mean, that's a harsh way to put it, but yes. And to be honest, and we're kind of dancing around the top guys here, but I was surprised by how frustrated he was after the race, because in my mind, this was no worse than Nashville. The only difference is Nashville, he got a trophy. But I feel as though Nashville and Philadelphia go hand in hand as underwhelming, not what he needed, disappointing performances.
Yeah, I could see why, because like I said, I don't know if the realization was, it would be an interesting question for him, is just, you know, how much of yourself did you put out there the first lap? But like I said, is the frustration really that you got tight and you got beat, or is the frustration knowing that's it? Like, I cannot do this. It is not possible unless something happens to Jet, because that's basically, even after Nashville, I was like, okay, Coop could come out this next weekend, whole shot, control it. We'll see if Jet can back up Nashville. You know, there was still an air of mystery or question marks, but to see him, like I said, if I could see very easily being in that position of Coop, like my thought would be, like, if that really was him again throwing everything out the first couple laps, like, do you just sit there and go, what do I do? Like, is that it? Because
I mean, the best really, way to sum that 12, up
is it 12 points now?
Yeah, the best way to sum that up is if Coop goes 1-1 at the last 2 rounds, Jet finishes 3rd and 4th, Jet will still win the championship. Yeah.
Saying now it's put in a position where you can't even bank off of, like I said, going before this weekend, you could kind of play off the, okay, if Coop can get a win at Philly, and then in one of the last rounds gets a little bit of luck, and Jet gets a 3rd or a 4th, and he can control race, because, Chase and Eli are riding excellent. There was still that feeling of possibility, but now it could still happen, but it really feels like it's, to me, even at this point, it doesn't even take Jet just falling down the first corner, because we've lost a little bit of field behind him, looking what he did in the short time in the heat race, something big has to happen in Jet the next 2 weeks. So again, that's where I could see that frustration coming from. And back to the heat racing, one other comment I wanted to make about Jet is, look, all your top guys, of course, are better than the guys behind him. Shocker to say that. But watching Jet in the heat race, it cracked me up watching guys that are some of the best in the world, how quickly he dispatches of them. And it reminds me of when you're at your local track and your local pro blows your doors off and you're just enamored, or one of these bottom field guy shows up and you're just like, oh my god, how can somebody ride a dirt bike better than that? And I'm wondering how some of the guys who were in a 450 main event watch him blow by and go, what the hell, like, it's going to be funny to be that good on a motorcycle and probably still have the same feeling and experience that every Joe Blow does on a weekend when somebody blows their doors off.
And to your point about something needing to happen at the last two rounds, that 24-lap main event was picture perfect from Jet. I believe there was one instance where on the Supercross triple, he was slightly offline and a little off balance, but not in any way was it like a mistake that cost him time. It was just a little like, oh, that's not exactly perfect. So yeah, it's not even like you can look at his race and go, oh, well, that was close and that was close. And if you put pressure on him there, that does turn into a crash. It was just perfect. And when you're competing against perfection, I do not know what you do, especially when perfection has a 12-point buffer. So yeah, not to completely just downplay the final two rounds of his championship, but in my mind, and I got heat for saying this last week, in my mind, Jet's 12-point lead may as well be 112 points.
Yeah, again, because he's so unbeatable. It's like you said, when you can get third or fourth, the margin on one hand, at any other point in the season, you would say is not that big. At this point, it's insurmountable without an issue. It is not possible for anyone else to win this title in a heads-up fashion, in my opinion. It is going to take something, in a sense, bad, a mechanical, a big wreck. It's going to take something beyond, I'd say even at this point, like Jet can make a mistake. Jet can fub something, land on a tough block, bounce off the track. He's going to get up and still be good enough. This is fine. This takes something in the catastrophic level to put him out of this. And yeah, again, that's where I see that frustration. Just like if you're somebody like Cooper, and you know, Cooper's probably such a competitor. He's been in it all season, but I'm sure before Nashville, those two rounds, like he believes in himself. The door looked creaked open. That huge points gap the Jet had go away. You know, he had to believe in himself. Everybody's camp, that's where he needed to be. He needed to trust in himself and believe the opportunity was there. But like I said, Nashville, it feels like the door just got that open door just got slammed in your face.
Chase did have another brilliant ride. So there is something for him to hang his hat on. He said in a press conference after the race that seeing as he is now out of the championship, he just told the team to use this as testing, and he rode with a setup that he had never used before in Foxborough, and that helped him unlock some of his raw speed. So that's positive, I guess. Obviously sucks that he's out of the championship, but yeah, I felt like that was a great ride. And you know what? He got held up by back markers in the sand one lap. If it wasn't for that, the gap probably would have been shorter. Jet would have won, but the gap would have been closer at the end. So, yeah, I would honestly be surprised if Chase doesn't win one of the final two. But, again, he has got to figure out the starts. I think he hole shot the fake start in timed qualification, and then obviously the heat was terrible, and the main event was just another mediocre start, which is never going to work when the field is still as strong as it is at the top. So yeah, positives to take away, and actually, as Chase put on Instagram, he just needs to spend 5 hours practicing starts this week.
Hey, before we completely depart the conversation, I had one more Jet question for you. I heard somebody comment this over the weekend. Can't remember where. The Jet had commented in an interview that he has basically done no outdoor testing because he's been banged up during the week. And like I said, I just thought I heard this in passing, and I know Honda had a huge test out at their facility recently. So am I missing something? Am I just an idiot?
That was my press day interview. Well, yeah, so that was my press day interview, and when he said I was banged up, I was like, shit, he's been injured. I need
That's
to
what
ask.
I'm saying. That's what
so
I'm
then, So then when he was talking, I was like, right, here we go. Next question. What the hell happened? And then I had enough time to go, oh, hang on. The Barsha incident happened before the weekend off. So that would have been why he was that would have been the thing that banged him up.
Okay.
But yeah, in the moment, my initial reaction was like, oh my god, what's happened? And then yeah, I luckily there was enough time for me to not make myself look like an idiot and go and like kind of reason with myself as to what had happened. But yeah, I mean, maybe it isn't that, but you know, the dates match up and it all is common sense. But yeah, I would imagine he's maybe done more outdoor testing than he made it seem, because he made it seem like he has done pretty much zero.
Yeah, and that's what I was wondering. I was wondering if there was something a la how Hunter has ridden through so much. I'm like, okay, maybe when we kind of had a, I don't want to say a weak jet, but those couple rounds where a jet just wasn't clicking. I'm like, oh, maybe there's something we're missing. And again, yeah, if the barge thing happened, they had a lot planned during that. I know they were still at the facility testing. Like, Kennard was out there, Hunter Chance, I think Joe even flew out for that. Like, they, from my awareness, they did like everything out there. So maybe that's what he means. Maybe he just feels like he missed all the big testing and opportunity. Maybe he had to take it mellow that week and just, at least he was there, probably got to go through his brother's feedback and at least work off that. And woohoo, he's on the same platform as he went perfect last year. So not the end of the world, like if that was Chase or somebody.
I think I said this last week, but I do hear positive stuff about Chase and the KTM outdoors. And as you would expect, KTM have endless data outdoors, stuff to lean on from GPs this year. Like, you would expect that to start in a much more settled place than Supercross. So,
I would think even just the fact that like Supercross, of course, started so negative. Now that they are catching up, like, you got to think the mindset of everybody there has to feel a little more like united front. Like, okay, we're making progress. Whether it's Chase himself, just everybody around him, it's got to be a little bit better feeling. But speaking of everybody around him, I've got to minorly address the elephant in the room. Different mechanic this weekend.
Yeah, and as you would expect, not black and white as to the reason why. I heard that Brandon Zimmerman, Chase's former mechanic now, who was with him at HRC and moved to KTM with him, I had heard that he and KTM were not exactly gelling earlier in the season. Like, it just wasn't really a match made in heaven. So I don't believe this is Nashville only, which is what some people are running with. But obviously, I'm just speculating. I don't know for sure. But
I'd heard a little bit similar. You got to think it's got to be tough for somebody in his position. You know, you think of him and Chase, like, okay, you've got a championship rider moving teams. It's a big signing. They have the power to ask for whatever they want. They want to bring their guy. But each of these teams are their own environment. Like, yeah, some guys, because I know plenty of mechanics that have been on one team, super happy. Everybody there likes them. They move to another team and it just doesn't gel. It just doesn't work. And so thinking, like, I think all the guys at KTM, I think of Frankie and Carlos and Jade and Kyle there and replace them. Like, all those dudes are super cool to talk to. They seem to have a great environment when I'm around there. A lot of joking around. Like, it's serious, but also fun. Like, I don't think of it as, you know, there's one other team I know that's very intense. I'll just say, like, Star has a very intense feel to it. KTM doesn't have that. And I think coming, like, you know, Brand came from Honda, like, Lars seems to run like a pretty good balance. So, but yeah, sometimes it just doesn't work, bluntly.
Yeah, and I heard someone say, like, he never should have left Honda. But if I'm in that position and my rider wins a Supercross championship go with them, I'm going with them.
Well, especially if you were staying at Honda, what was he going to do? Because the Lawrences were each going to bring up their mechanics. So really, his only option was to go back to 250s with Shimoda. If they wouldn't have brought him on, or if he would have stayed, he would have probably moved back to 250s with Joe, and Ben Griffith, that was hired as the test guy, probably would have stayed in that role. That would be my guess of how it would have worked out. The only rights I guess we'll touch on, though, like, kind of makes sense. So Zim, for anybody didn't know, I don't know his full background. I just remember he was at PC with AC after, I believe the guy's name was Brent Mountain, left. He was with AC for a couple years, took an in-house job at Kawasaki, I want to say for 2 years. I could be wrong on that timeline. And then, you know, when Jay Dungey left HRC Honda from Chase to go to KTM, Chase requested Zim, from my understanding. They worked here, you know, a couple of years at Honda and then moved over. We all know that Shanti recently left Cowie for NASCAR. So technically speaking, Cowie's down a guy. They're in a position where they didn't need to get somebody, but I believe Zim's relationship is great there. So I'm not saying that anybody's talking about it. Just would not shock me if Zim ends up at Cowie.
And speaking of Cowie, Jason Anderson was back on the podium. And I have a topic for Jason Anderson. So I believe we said this on a recent podcast, but the way that you view a rider is all really down to personal expectation, because you and I could be saying exactly the same thing, but you could be saying it in a positive way and I could be saying it in a negative way, purely on our personal stance and expectation of said rider. And where I'm going with this is I still look at Jason Anderson as, like, if he's not a consistent podium guy and battling for wins, then it can't be good and it has to be a disappointment. I still hold him to that regard. Mm-hmm. But then in talking to him over the weekend, I kind of got the feeling that he doesn't hold himself in that regard. So then I was like, well, maybe I need to, like, change my viewpoint a little bit. And then I was wondering now, which is why I bring this to this podcast, what your viewpoint of him is.
See, I lean a little bit more towards yours, like, especially what he did 2 years ago. Yes, a lot of those wins came, you know, that was hurt, but like, Jason was fantastic that year, and we kind of joked about how he seemed to be an every other year guy. To me, he still is held to that regard. If you look at Cowie, you know, even by the time he was brought in, AC was starting to deal with his issues. So, like, AC wasn't the, I don't, you know, to me, Cowie's never had a clear cut number one, but I'll be honest, like, as soon as AC started to deal with his issues and it started becoming kind of obvious, like, okay, his time is limited, to me, especially after Jason did that first year, like, Jason did feel kind of like the number one guy in a way. And I kind of feel like any Factory 450 team, if you're hired and you're going to be that guy, you are expected to be a podium level guy, like, consistently. That's just, I think, the expectation of the status, the paycheck, his past results, the team's past results, that's what you're expecting. Yes, those go up and down a little bit every year. I could see on a down year him taking a step back on that stance and a little bit maybe if other people viewing it. But yeah, in general, I still look at it as like, yeah, if he has a good weekend and he's not on the podium, that's not great. Okay, some fourths and fifths, but like I said, his was so up and down at points. Yeah, I'm a little lost. Like, the third this weekend, it's hard because he beat, you know, Webb was tied, but the other, like, he rode fantastic, and it's just, it's, like, when you talked to him, I haven't listened to an interview yet, like, how excited was he about the third?
Well, I don't know if, and I've not really spoken to him enough to have this opinion, but I would say that, is he ever, like, really radiating excitement? I don't feel like there's ever, like, he's pumped vibe.
Even it's kind of funny, he seems to be, and maybe this is just, I would almost raise Spar Jason a little bit when I have interviewed him, because there for a while he was kind of recluse and you didn't talk to him. Ever since he got to Cowie, he's been more open. He kind of, no matter if it's good or bad, kind of seems to carry the same attitude. So I don't know, maybe that's just part of who he is, maybe that's part of his game face, but bad or good, the attitude doesn't seem to shift too much, at least that he outwardly portrays.
He said, regarding the incident with Cooper Webb in the final turn, they did touch, obviously. Yeah. And I asked him if, I think I posed the question in this manner, which was, okay, last lap, last corner, anything goes, but did it cross your mind at all that Webb is in a title fight and you should maybe just, like, let him, like, be nice or just let him have this one? And he said it did run through his mind briefly, but then he's got to cash those bonus checks. Mm-hmm. So, and just to make my stance clear, I have no problem with Anderson going for that.
And I saw some comments that were actually negative towards him about it. And I was kind of shocked. I'm like, that wasn't egregious. It was him trying to pinch it off. I'm guessing their bars caught from the angle I saw is what it looked like. They didn't fully bounce off each other, but it was a little bit, and it got Coop off balance and drug him off. I'm like, okay, that wasn't an egregious hit, number one. Number two, yeah, it's going for third. It's going for bonus check. At this point, Jason's out of the title, so he's, you know, trying to make some bonus money. I get the stance a little bit. I'm definitely, I commonly say there's a race going on, you're not in it, whether that's deeming of lappers or even championship battle. But it's different if Webb, like I said, Jet, that's what's happened the last 2 weekends. Like, Jet was taking control of it. Cooper wasn't in that position. It would be very different to me if it was like Coop and Jet, obviously, if one of them was like way back and it's the leading of the two and you do that to him, or if it's Jet first, Coop second, and Jason's already on the podium and they're close and he does it last. It's a little different, but in the situation it is, is what it is.
I do not have the balls to ask Eli this, but I do wonder this. So although I won't ask him, we will discuss this. Obviously, and maybe it's done, but we know that there is at least some discussion about 2025 Supercross. The idea is being pondered. I wonder where his emotions are at, because if you look at his last four results, first, sixth, second, fifth. So the last four results are basically great, meh, great, meh. I wonder if his emotions fluctuate with that, where he's like, great result, can't wait for 2025, bad result, screw this, I don't want to do it. Great result, can't wait. You know, like, I wonder if when it comes to making a decision for next year, if he is riding that wave with the results.
I don't know, because the first is so good. Because before that, you saw that, like, he touched the podium and he'd be pretty. You could see a look in his face. He was a little bit happier, but then if he had a bad weekend, you'd go to interview him and you could tell from the vibe he was not about it. Where even coming this week, when he's had the bad ones, if you've come on press to anybody, he seems to be better the way he's carrying it a little bit. But I'd be curious, because I think it got brought up in your press day interview with him. It kind of comes along lines of you got to imagine for him again. He doesn't seem to be an all-time record chaser. He's already crushed so many things. The stress had to be there super high when he wasn't, couldn't get a Supercross title done, basically, the thing that was missing. Now that that's done and really he has his legacy set, I would think the wins are enough to carry you through the downs, if that makes sense, because he's out of the title. He doesn't need to win another title to raise any question marks about his career. It's just awesome that he's there and he's bounced back and he's trying. So maybe earlier in his career, but I would think right now the high stays there a little more between each round, because what is there to be down about? He had a bad race. Who gives a fuck? You're still got millions in the bank. You're one of the best that's ever done it. You've won kind of a little bit of everything, and you're winning against somebody who might come along down the road to crush your records. Enjoy it.
I would actually like to get his answer to that question, but I believe the question, because even you could ask Coca that and it would be quite interesting, but I believe the question would be interpreted as some sort of backhand way of gaining knowledge on 2025 plans. So I don't think it would be like, I don't know how you'd word it, where it would be accepted or interpreted in a genuine way, which kind of it is. But I can see how you would take that as like, oh, you're just trying to read between the lines and get some 2025 insight. Yeah. So maybe I'll get onto the drawing board and figure out a good way to phrase that question. Barsha was sixth and had a great battle with Hunter Lawrence in seventh. There was positives for both riders. Hunter was, of course, the fastest qualifier, which was great. Actually, no, he wasn't the fastest qualifier.
Did you see the lap where Hunter and him were going through the whoops and Hunter's foot slipped off and he just basically held it on? They almost kind of pinched off like the Cooper Barsha, or sorry, the Cooper Jason thing. That was absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, it was a great race, and they had words afterwards, and I was like, oh no, but I guess they were all good, and it was actually like that was awesome. No, that was, yeah, you were awesome. No, you were awesome conversation.
I feel like Barsha is one of those guys, like, if you, because he, like I said, definitely Hunter's foot slipped, and he just stayed on it, so he had to push Barsha pretty hard at the end, and then Barsha immediately got really aggressive the next section or two, and I was thinking, oh, Justin probably took that very wrong, what happened at the whoops. But anytime I've seen, if it never goes to full kill shot when you relate Bam Bam to, if you pull off the track, I feel like, and tell him, like, that was gnarly, that was sick, I feel like he responds that way. But if you go up to him and say, F you, then I think, you know, it comes around very quickly from him, F you too.
Yeah, I would agree. Malcolm Stewart had some bright spots, but ultimately ended up in the same range of positions that he has been in. And once again, a bad start. He was nowhere to be seen towards the front. Dylan Ferrandis returned from injury / illness and did what Dylan Ferrandis was doing pre-injury / illness. Benny Bloss and Colt Nichols were joint at the hip in the results, and I feel as though that's happened a few times this year. Must be because they are admiring each other's beta so fondly that they like to stay close. Vital MX is proudly supported by Beta Motorcycles, which has been a family-owned company since 1905. Beta manufactures the finest enduro, trials, dual sport, and motocross motorcycles that are known for their top quality and rideability. Their newest model, the 450RX, is the first four-stroke motocross model built by Beta. It was designed to offer a ride that is more forgiving, with the rare combination of premium performance and undeniable appeal. Check out betausa.com for more information. Yeah, good for Benny and good for Colt. Especially good for Colt, because he has had some rough times recently. And actually, Justin Bogle went to the race purely to, like, dig Colt out of the hole that he found himself in. So I think Bogle was very very big on the, like, you know how good you are, so you need to, like, snap out of it, like, you can do this. I think that was kind of the approach there. This is a rapid move on to 250s, but shall we move on to 250s?
I only have one more 450 for you.
Okay.
Justin Cooper, 10th. Not one of his bare weekends, but followed. He had a great weekend last weekend. We've talked about, like, unless we talk about him, nobody does, because, you know, Justin, just the demeanor carries himself, but he's had an excellent 450 rookie season. He's on a 1-year deal. I know he has verbiage in his contract for a re-up if he hits certain targets. No clue what those targets are. Imagine they're a bit on the lofty side. You know, his position, I'm high on. We've talked about it multiple times. I think you agree with me. Like, I think he's worth investing in it in the sense in the future. Do you think he stays put? Do you think, number two, he should stay put? If he doesn't, you know, where could he land and why?
I would suspect that he will stay put, mainly because after the weird schedule that he did last year, whilst he was effectively waiting for Star to open a 450 seat for him, I feel like he's just too in there, because if he was going to leave, last year would have been the time to do it, surely. Where could he go?
I think it's a weird year where actually the opposite would be you stay put, because there's a good amount of 450 deals up next year, because the only thing that would be available is that second Husky seat is really the only valuable spot available, I guess.
And was there not some sort of Justin Cooper to Husqvarna hype at some point recent, like not recently as in this year, but in previous years, or have I just made that up?
I mean, back in 250s, from what KTM tried to get him, but for the KTM side of it, they tried to get him on a 250 to 450 contract when, you know, he was available when one of his contracts was expiring at Star, and Star had to step up quite a bit to keep him. I don't know if 454 last year, if there was conversations about it, or the Craig situation or not. I don't know. But like I said, that's the only one I can think of. But considering the 450 side of Husky is still kind of meh, probably best bet is stay at Star. But if he does another year, like if he can kind of build a little bit off this even next year and just put in a little bit better results, there's a lot of positions open. He actually could, well, actually scratch that, Triumph 450 spot also.
I hear more and more and more that the Triumph 450 is not going to be ready. More like, I know we've had this conversation off record, yeah, but even again in the last week, I'm hearing it more and more and more.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting, because if you're Joey, if it's really not ready, if you're Joey, then, oh, another year of racing 250 only outdoors.
And actually remind me, because I know of an offer that Triumph have made to a rider, which is going to blow your socks off. So remind me afterwards, because you'll want to hear this, but I will forget. Back to the original topic of Cooper. So logically, what would make sense is you stick with Star, and you know that ultimately Eli will retire, if not this year, the end of next year, you would think. And then you effectively take Eli's spot, some of his money, all is well. Right? That must be what Justin Cooper's dreaming of.
Well, but say then you have like the weight of, you know, I think as long as he has a good year next year, Deegan still after 25 moves up. But
I was going to say. I feel like Justin Cooper could be banking on that, but then potentially Deegan moves to 450s in 2020. Six. And so ultimately, although it all looks like it could work out, I feel like Cooper could always end up on the outside looking in as star, as a part of the team, but not an integral part of the team. And I wonder how that would affect his psyche, his outlook, etc., etc. So actually, considering all of this, and although it would be daunting and a scary step, I wonder if just breaking free and rolling the dice and seeing what happens could be the best possible thing for his career.
That's kind of what I was getting at. Because you could say on one hand, oh, wait one more year and then maybe pull that trigger. Or does that come up this year? Just kind of that long-term thing. Like, is, you know, he's been there long enough in a sense. You hear people say they need a change. You know, is there always going to be that fact? Like, Stars 450 program is big enough. You're going to have Webb there for another year plus a one-year option. Eli basically can say whether he wants to race or not. You know, they've got a bank on making Hayden a good 450 offer. As long as they kind of have that powerhouse 250 side leading up to it, there's always people coming in. So eventually, you're never going to be the primary guy there. If he can step himself up again a little bit next year and start catching attention, yeah, again, do you try to get a spot at, you know, at Cowie? Do you try to get a spot somewhere? Do you go, man, I could be a little bit... feel a little bit more like a 450 focus for somebody, and would that actually make the difference for him?
I like the idea of Husky. And you know what? Maybe you're different. I have not heard a single rumor of Husky second 450 seat for next year.
The only one I've heard, and I know Seth, the person who is May's agent, I think was at least inquiring into it, was potential for Ferrandis.
But I did hear that one. Yeah, I forgot about that.
I think, I mean, you've discussed this. I wouldn't be terribly shocked. Like, theoretically, they may not. I mean, if you deem it's not worth taking Christian for another year, if you're in a position where the focus is so much on RJ, they have a little more 250s than usual, maybe they only run one 450 for a year until it's kind of like, okay, you know, decide if Malcolm is going to up enough to stay again, or if RJ is just going to get his spot, and then you open it up, you go back to two 450s if there's somebody else available. Because if they're not required to run a second one, I could also, if you know, Rockstar Husky, everybody's happy enough with some of the 250 side of the team, maybe, yeah, you just don't do it for a year.
Well, and I also feel as though we're back to there being some rumors floating around about where Husky falls in the pecking order of KTM, GasGas, etc. So I've just written it down in my phone that next time I go to a GP, I need to do an interview with Pitt or Robert and ask them for their... I need to ask them for some sort of definitive hierarchy of what they want from each of their race teams. Because... They can't all win, obviously. So that is now in my phone as a to-do item. Right. And speaking of to-do, how about 250s? that was a terrible segue, but...
Right. You know. Good job. You tried.
In my head, it sounded much more similar. But anyway, so much to unpack with 250s. Let's start with the winner, of course, Max Anstey. Honestly, and I didn't consider this until after he had won... After all of the preseason hype and all of that stuff, if he hadn't won a race this year, I think it would have been a bust. So great from that outlook. His first dry Supercross win. So in an essence, his first true Supercross win. So a massive deal. And yeah, good for him. I thought, yeah, it was a great ride. Got a good start, which is rare for him this year. And nice pass on Seth. Some great lines, tripling. Before the whoops and then skimming, that was brilliant. Tripling into the sand, that was lovely. Speaking of the sand, loved that whole section. I could have watched the guys do that on repeat for hours.
One of the, if not the best sand section I've seen in a Supercross, at least in a long time.
Well, I also liked the sand, not loved, but I liked the sand section in Nashville. So like, I feel like the sand is on a bit of a come up.
Well, I think it's fun when there's like rhythm in or out, like when it's not just, ooh, a sand corner that the guys, a 1A sand corner that the guys are just dog paddling through on Supercross suspension.
Good for Max, though. I guess I haven't really got much more substance to add to it, but good for Max.
Yeah, just a reminder of what he can do. And, you know, there's the rumors floating around where he'll be next year, which I'm really excited to see where that all kind of lands out. Because, like, this is a reminder, like, Max can do it, plain and simple. And again, it's just... It's fun to watch when you look at everybody behind him that is Tom, a little bit different case, but considering Max's actual road to get here to legitimately beat some of these guys, it's we all know that Max is a world-class talent, but the path he used to get here is really, really cool.
Yeah, and I guess I haven't seen that part of the press conference yet, but I guess he said that he has something exciting coming up next year. So,
since we're on, I'll use this as the segue on the topic because I actually wanted to talk about this. I'll do a video on this summer week or so. I want to do some sort of feature on it. There's a good chance that Max, there's other teams after him. Let's just go with what is likely to happen. He departs Firepower Honda. Dean Wilson retires at the end of the season. What the heck do they do next year?
Well, this is actually a topic that could work for many teams. And that's that if you are a satellite team, I feel as though Firepower can really hang their hat on. Hey, yeah. We will be the leg up that you need in your career to get to where you want to go. But you have to have that attitude. I think if you try to approach it from we are as good as A, B, and C team, then that's questionable. And it's a bit like, you hear that and you're like, I don't really know what's going on there. Like, but if you can like market yourself to riders as we can further your career and we will be happy to see you go elsewhere. We will be happy to drive you to bigger and better things. Then, I could see like this working out. This working out as a nice little story for the team.
Well, especially with some of the, again, we talk about starts like, okay, what's Romano going to do? What is Thrasher going to do? What happens?
We'll get Romano would make a lot of sense.
I was saying, I kind of laugh that it's almost like because where they're based, it's like, hey, star guy didn't work out. You want to come over here? You could still probably ride at the same place. You just want to drive down here? Don't have to sell your house.
Who did you say? Romano,
like a Thrasher.
Thrasher re-signed a star.
Oh, he did. I kind of figured that one was gone. But, you take some... Hey, Enzo Lopes. You didn't get anything after your 1 year. You want to come up here and try?
But so I guess I heard that Enzo Lopes is going to get another go next year.
Mm-hmm.
But with no money and no, prove yourself stuff. I really feel like we should say more about Max's win, but good job.
Wire to wire, great job. Not wire to wire. Had to. So, actually, we'll get to a Seth, but damn, that was fun to watch those two.
So, I left Philadelphia, and my winner of Philadelphia across both classes was not Jet Lawrence, and it was not Max Anstey. It was Tom Vial, because that was undoubtedly his best Supercross ride ever.
100%.
I tweeted that was his best Supercross ride ever. Before I changed that tweet at the last minute, what I was originally going to tweet was that was his best ride ever.
Oh.
It was so good that I rank it even above all of his MXGP rides. But I realized that would probably start stuff. So I went with the safe option. But genuinely, that is how impressed I was. There was aggression. There was intensity. He had Hayden barking behind him. The entire race did not get phased at all. In fact, there was no reason for him to be phased because he was clearly the better rider. Every time Hayden would get kind of close, Tom would just move on. It felt that was not Tom Vial that I was watching. That felt like a new edition of Tom Vial, and even a new edition in comparison to Nashville 1 week earlier. It was phenomenal. And to be honest with you, a nice, what would you say? It was a real signal as to how much progress he has made in a short amount of time. Because the way he performed on Saturday night was night and day different to last year and the beginning of this year.
Yes. I mean, but simply, Hayden was fine. I don't know if Hayden ever applied a lot of pressure, but I mean, his situation coming into this, to close, in a sense, the door, to give him the best shot in the shootout, which can be true chaos. He needed to go out and, regardless of the situation, beat Hayden. They both didn't get excellent starts. And honestly, I believe Hayden was ahead in the first rhythm lane. So, I mean, he made it happen quick. He continued to pick guys off. Yeah, lappers would catch him up, or sorry, people, back markers he was going through would catch him up a little bit every once in a while, but he would dispatch of guys quickly. Like I said, a great mix of aggression, racing forward, but also like a certain calmness. Just absolutely phenomenal ride. There's nothing you can take away from that guy for what he did.
And don't forget, I'm pretty sure no one in the media, in the industry, had him pegged as a favorite to win this championship. And he is, yeah, he will most likely win it with conviction. So, I guess hats off is my main takeaway. Like, simply brilliant. And 15 points is his advantage now heading into the showdown. So honestly, even if he crashes on lap one, I like his chances of finishing 12th or wherever he needs to finish to get this done. So I honestly just cannot fathom a way in which Tom Vial does not win this championship.
Yeah. The other one that's interesting is just the dynamic for KTM in general. Is it makes me wonder how they lean towards, you know, the Kunins coming over, other ones. It's like, okay, backtrack their history. They really can't get it done with bringing up U.S. amateurs, but they bring somebody over from Europe and they can get it done. Kenny, Marv, GL back in the day. Look what they're doing now with Tom. It's like, okay, do you just continue that path because your amateur path isn't working?
It seems more and more that the Kunins will be coming in 2025, not 2026. Which I don't know how that fits into KTM's plans if that happens, but it seems like that is slowly gathering some traction. And actually, to your point, it sounds like Roger is very excited to have the Kunins. So maybe they have identified that that is their niche.
I guess that's good because you would put Luca at KTM, but I'm guessing what do you do with, I guess, TLD? Because Huskies are going to have three guys. I'll put KTM at 3250 guys. Guessing that means you have to put Sasha at TLD?
Yeah, as a third 250. No, but
they're going to have, oh God, help me here. Aussie kid, at least for
Cole outdoors. Davies.
Yeah, Davies is going to be sort of on like a futures to outdoors deals with them, I believe, next year under a more, like, he's in TLD gear now. He's on a gas cast, but he's not officially a part of their effort where it looks like it's going to morph into more of an official deal.
Yeah, and Ryder D's under contract, and I would presume now that they will keep Pierce Brown.
Or I was going to say, what if that's the deciding factor and Pierce just gets booted just purely from even above TLD? What if just overall Austria management's like, sorry, we need that spot for a Kunin. Bye.
Okay, yeah, I guess that could be possible. I could be possible. So speaking of the fact that none of us picked Tom Vial to win this championship, most people picked Hayden Deegan. Mm-hmm. So how much of a, not disappointment, but how much of a blow is it if he does not win this championship?
I thought about this last night because I asked Star at the beginning of the year, you know, they have him under contract through 25 with an option for 26 if he wants to do another year on 250s. If, you know, they said basically if he doesn't win the title this year, unless, you know, you kind of would think based on how he rode the end of outdoors last year, he still is among either the favorite for outdoor or amongst the conversation probably between what him, Tom, and like RJ or him, Tom, Levi, whatever, how RJ's in there. Yes. So, he still comes out maybe more long run if he also doesn't win the outdoor title. It would be, but if he wins the outdoor title, he wins a supercross title next year, he defends outdoors again, he still goes, I still suspect he goes 450 and 26. I don't see him staying down unless he just can't get the supercross job done. So in the short term, a little disappointing, but also just a reminder, hey, he's young and not everybody can have, we have the generational talent with Jet. It's really hard to see that happen two times in a row where the kid just goes through and wins everything, you know, on their path to 450s.
Yeah, I agree with all that you said. The only thing I would add is if he doesn't win this championship, maybe it adds a little more pressure to him outdoors and he like feels more of a need to get it done. So that could be interesting to watch. It was interesting actually in the press conference. It really did sound like he was almost dismissive of the 250 title now and was like, yeah, I need to test for outdoors. I need to, like, it sounded like he was very much like, yeah, I'm onto outdoors. I need to win that.
Blog it. And I guess, you know, if you're his stance, yeah, the pressure is there, but also maybe the stance of just plan to kill everybody the first round or two and try to reset that expectation, if that makes sense. Like, if, you know, you've given Tom a lot of, like, Tom's our confident outdoors, but you give him this, RJ and Levi are going to be coming off highs, depending. I mean, both of them going down to the wire on the tile, they're both going to come off highs. If RJ wins, he knows he can win a championship. Levi already took such a huge gain this year. So, I mean, all those guys coming outdoors and then seeing Hayden lose a title, probably think, oh, we can do this. If you're Hayden, yeah, you would probably want to try to demo them the first round or two to kind of reset the pecking order, in a sense, if you're him.
So the next hot topic, Hamaker and Swole. We'll do the incident first. I would say that it was just a racing incident. Swole has to take more blame. 70-30, 60-40 is where I would be bouncing between. But ultimately, I don't believe it was malicious or dirty. It was just a racing incident and a miscalculation of timing from Swole's side. I would imagine he felt like he would get to the outside slightly quicker and basically get there with enough time for Hamaker to stop rather than actually torpedoing Hamaker. How do you view it?
A little bit the same. Like, I lean towards racing incident, but if you're, yeah, I a little bit when it happened, because the moment I heard the and saw this both in the sand without even seeing the replay, because was it Swole and Max? Like, it almost happened with Max and Seth the one lap when Max started tripling in.
Yes, I remember that.
It came very close. And I was like, ooh, that would be nasty, because that's going to be a hell of an impact. I remember thinking that after the Max one. So when I saw Swole and Seth laying there and the way they're laying, I'm like, oh, Swole torpedoed in by tripling. Like, it was dead instant to me. And then watching the replay, I'm just like, yeah, I get it. To me, as racing, you're both battling for second. I get it. Swole felt very much like this was probably his night after the heat race. You know, he's a bit brash. I really like Jalik, but I was like, okay, I get it with his attitude why he did this. Not the greatest decision on the face of the earth, but it is kind of what it is. Like I said, blame pie. I lean a little bit towards Jalik not making a great decision, but it's racing. But then listening to both their interviews afterwards slightly changes that perception because of the mindsets. Like, the one interview I watched with Jalik, it kind of starts with the, oh, it's an incident, but then kind of goes into, you know, Seth could have checked up, Seth could have stopped, Seth could have this. And, you know, there's the comment where Seth basically said yelled at him after the race. And I'm kind of like, okay, yeah, Jalik definitely misread the situation, because I keep rewatching. I guess I get Jalik's point. He probably legitimately in his mind thinks Seth should have seen me land there and would have just pumped the brakes like I was putting nose in. But I think of being the rider's position, you're Seth, you're railing the sand berm, you come out and when you're in the sand particularly, yes, if you chop the throttle, but you're also off the back, you're fully committed trying to get the bike to drive, and all of a sudden out of your peripheral, here comes like the way Jalik comes into that corner. Like, yeah, it's game over. So the interviews, I feel bad because the comments aren't great on social. And then if you watch the two interviews, Seth seems a little like, Seth is a very level headed guy, and Jalik doesn't do himself a great favor by the way he states it. He kind of starts there, but it leans a little bit where people aren't going to take it the best. But yeah, it's just racing. People are going to get really fired up over this, and who cares?
Tell me to shut up, because potentially I said this on last week's podcast. I can't remember if I found this before the podcast or after the podcast last week. But does anyone remember that Jalik Swole has already had a podium? Because I completely forgot until I saw it in black and white.
Yeah, I remember, but barely. It wasn't in front of my mind. But I guess that brings in a whole conversation. Like, we know Jalik's capable of it. They did reveal, I guess, Jalik was at start of the season with two fractures in his back, though.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think they brought that up in the broadcast that actually before the season, he had tweaked his back and he has like two small compression fractures or something. But what I was going to say is, in general, you know, there's the negative of last week of Evan Ferry, which 99% of people like, hey, Evan didn't make a great choice. But considering the question marks coming into this, maybe the struggles the team had attracting talent. We all know that Levi Kitchen had an offer to go there and rode the bike, kind of dismissed it. Or some other people attested, dismissed the idea. With what Jalik's doing, again, with 250s, you got to think that they're in a much better bargaining position than they were a year ago.
Well, once again, remind me to tell you when I stop recording. but no, something must have changed or been improved on either Jalik or the bike before Nashville, because Nashville and Philadelphia Jalik is like night and day difference to the Jalik we had previously. Top five at the showdown, of course. And then, yeah, he was likely going to finish on the podium. Okay, but let's do that. If Jalik gets by Seth cleanly there, does he finish on the podium, or do Vial and Deegan get him?
He finishes on the podium.
I think so too, because not only would Vial and Deegan have had to get him, they also would have had to get around Seth. So that would have taken time as well.
Seth, you know, Seth was very driven. And in Seth's case, we'll talk about it again, because he's in the seat of needing a ride. Jalik did say he felt held up by Seth, which I kind of agree. Like, Seth was racing, even Max, like, Seth was racing phenomenally, but he's coming off a shoulder injury. He's not the strongest guy. He was not the fastest guy. Max was better than him. I would argue that Swole was better than him. And if we're going off pace, Deegan and Tom were probably better than Seth. Seth was executed his start and was racing well, and he was hard to pass. He had great lines. He was making it. Seth was not giving up any inch on anybody. He had his head down. I get it. Hometown crowd. He's racing for a contract right now. Seth is trying to prove something. I think legitimately, if Jalik pulled the move off, he gets away from Seth and not gets to Max, but at least kind of gets close to matching. I think he could have come close to matching Max's pace and built himself a gap on Seth to not have to deal with Tom and Hayden.
I have one comment on your man, Cody Shock, and that is that for some reason, there was a two-lap period in qualification where he was dangerous himself. He was the danger zone. I have no idea what was going on, but for two laps...
He tried to die every section for two laps.
He was casing stuff, getting whiskey, getting loot, and I was like, oh my, what is going on?
This happens with him. That's a common theme. I have watched him just... This actually happened at Salt Lake the 1 year. Was it Salt Lake? No, it was Tampa. It was the first round the 1 year. Screws up a rhythm lane, like everything in it. Case, and then tries to seat bounce a triple out of the inside of main one. Faces it, smashes his face, and hits his head is not quite all there for a lap. And comes off, and Archer's like, what are you doing? I didn't want to throw away my fast lap. And I think Tony looked at him and goes, how are you on a fast lap? You cased everything in the rhythm lane before it.
Yeah, and same this time, actually. I'm pretty sure I saw his head bounce off the bars this time as well.
Not shocking. I love... shocking. No, love Cody Death. He will not give up. Even when he probably should back it off for a second, he doesn't give up.
Tip of the hat to Preston Boesvloog for a ninth place.
Yeah, Boesvloog.
But what did I say?
Boesvloog? I think it's Boesvloog.
Okay, noted.
It's hard to pronounce.
Tip of the hat, ninth is good for him. 10th is a nice rebound for Nick Romano. Gage Linville, 11th, building on the East-West Showdown performance nicely. I believe that's a career best for him. And I've got to think that teams are starting to go, is there something there? Phoenix maybe? Even a club maybe?
I was going to say like a club. He's definitely in that position where Cody was once. A lot of guys like... A lot of times when somebody builds up like that, your big teams, of course, go, he's got to do it another year because guys have breakout years and have a hard time following it. But yeah, excellent. Be an excellent addition to like a club. It kind of sucks that he honestly, especially being Jordan, even though he's at the Lawrence's compound this year, he was a longtime MTF guy. It sucks that he already kind of had that first go with firepower, because like I could argue like, oh, he would be an excellent choice for him. But they already did that. So I don't. Don't know where the relationship is.
Yeah, I don't know how that ended, but it would almost make sense for him to go back there.
Yeah.
But so,
that's an excellent choice. Even it's not that far. Like, again, I know he really likes being at the Lawrence compound. It's not that far. Maybe they would allow him to, you know, still do that. The Honda relationship, that would actually be excellent. I think he'd be a great choice, especially with Dean. Like, if it's not a big name 450 guy, what if they do two 250s next year? He could be one of them. You know.
I wonder. I'm definitely like now invested in the Gage Linville story, because it is quite interesting how this is coming on. He is going to Salt Lake City with the Dirt Bike Depot team. I don't believe that was initially in the plan. So kind of a reaction to how well he's been doing. And actually, speaking of the Dirt Bike Depot team, Marcus Phelps another rider on the team had his career best result in 19th as well. Circling back to the top, Bennick was fourth and Heimis was fifth. Good job, but I have to put somewhat of an asterisk on it because Brown, Hammacher, and Swole were going to beat those riders. So,
yeah, so you automatically look at that as a seventh, eighth, and a ninth for bluntly.
Good job, but I'm not going to sit here and debate how good a fourth place is for Bennick because it wasn't really a fourth place. It was, but you get what I mean. I'm trying to say it nicely. You get what I mean.
Yeah.
And actually, I've got another thing to say nicely here. 2024, it is Fox Racing's 50th anniversary year, marking five decades of getting after it. Rides, innovations, victories celebrate 50 years of looking forward with Fox. Hello, future. Thank you to Fox Racing. Thank you to Beta. And thank you to Decal Works for their support of this podcast, as well as other content on Vital MX. Anything else?
When is Cochran? What are we? Two races in ProCar? Considering how quick he was last year, Futures, he's been hurt a lot since then. It's been a very quiet debut for, a very highly touted amateur. Spent a lot of time with Roxen as an amateur in the last couple of years, considering the support. I mean, he's got a deal for next year, but it's still kind of more meh. Eh?
Well, it's forgotten because it doesn't really count, but the only kind of bright light is he was, I want to say, fourth in his heat in Nashville. Which is obviously that was effectively a main event. It had all of the East riders in it. I don't know where that came from and why that isn't transferable in any way, shape, or form to these races. But on the flip side, I'm not sure that anyone is really banking on Cochran being a consistent podium guy at any point in the near future, or do you think otherwise?
He definitely, last year he killed Loretta's and Bees. There was talk that they changed all their plans. He was going to go the Hayden route, just do the first. He wasn't even really going to race A. He was going to do the first two futures, do the entire East Coast. He really stepped up last year. It was trending that direction. There can only be so many generational talents, but the direction he was going is still above kind of where he's been. It's definitely been a much quieter start to his pro career than I thought. Based on the support he has, skills, amateur accomplishments, thought he'd be a top 10 guy again, not getting beat by Henry Miller and people of that nature who have been here, done that forever and have, Henry, Hardy Munoz beating him. No offense to Hardy, but Hardy dies every time he touches the motorcycle in the track.
And the bad part is it's kind of another black eye on Husqvarna's record. Because aside from Hampshire, it's all kind of underwhelming.
It's kind of the continuous what this kind of comes off even more the KTM conversation. This just goes back to the entire brand's bringing of U.S. amateurs up. It's just, I know Blair's there, they're trying to redo some stuff, but it's still just kind of they've got plenty of them in the pipeline. Somebody's going to work out, but it's just another one where this is just not. It's so rude to say it's only three races in. Completely can change, but it just gives you that impression, man, it's still just it's not transferring correctly. It's just something about it just isn't giving me the wow factor, I guess.
Yeah, I would agree, but also I'm not, for some reason, yeah, maybe I'm off base, but I'm not exactly expecting the wow factor.
I'm expecting where Gage is. I think, with what he's got for backing, I don't expect him to be top five, but being okay, it's Basepflug's rookie season. Preston was on KTM and with a potential deal to pro and basically booted because he underperformed so bad his final amateur career year. He was on Team Green the year before, so underwhelmingly got booted off that. And he's on Barek Suzuki, not, pretty late start this year, etc. Ninth, Linville 11th. It's just one result I'm looking at, but it just kind of shot, looks at that's kind of at least where I expect him to be is 10th to 13th conversation.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Any random final thoughts? Anything we've got to talk about besides? I will say, my excitement for outdoors is really like kicked in out of nowhere. Like this time last week, I was really quite like, eh. And then for some, I don't know why, but for some reason, I'm kind of like, oh yeah, oh yeah.
Ooh. Oh, I'm there for all of it, just because it's a different. Okay, so last year coming in outdoors 250s, really, and I mean, I think you've got to almost go back and give Hunter more credit for what he did for pretty much racing the entire season injured. It was going to be the Hunter show. 450s, we had, you know, we had guys kind of going out. Webb was in a weird position where he didn't know if he was racing or not till the last minute. Tomac, like the classes, I don't know. I didn't have that much of a deep feeling and excitement, but yeah, what we just said about 250s. Okay, RJ, Levi, Hayden, Tom, like 250s is shaping up great for outdoors. 450s, who can bring it to Jet? Chase, you know, Webb's riding fantastic, full return outdoors. Be fun to watch him. Yeah, I'm just excited. Hunter on the 450, all that. I don't know. Both classes give me a lot of like reasons to be at least be excited for the first round. We'll see how it shapes out, but I'm at least excited for the first two or three.
Yeah, I have high hopes that like Chase and Jet will battle like they did at Parler last year for the entire season. That's kind of what I'm hanging my hat on. Yeah, this is still exciting. I mean, 250 West especially, and that's going to pick up this weekend. Let me ask you this, actually, because this was going to be something I was going to shoehorn in somewhere else. So it's now looking less and less likely that Yamaha will win a championship in Supercross this year. And of course, they were winless in Supercross last year as well. This is a weird little drought for Yamaha, who seemed as though they could do no wrong in years previous. So where does it, do we care? Do we acknowledge it? Or is it just like, eh, shit happens. Next year will be business as usual.
I think the class, you got, you know, separating class. It's interesting because Star takes over the 450 program. They're instantly successful based on what they did in 250s. It's like, okay, here's a dynasty. But we all like, okay, Jets kind of put a stop to that conversation. 450s. They've got Chase, who's the other biggest player in 450. It just feels like with 450s, they, you know, they got it. They, I don't want to say got lucky, because they had to make it happen and give him a reason, but they got Eli, but they almost got Eli like too late in his career, if that makes sense. So you're missing the boat on the big name 450 guy that can legitimately win. Okay, I'm thinking too much outdoors. I'm shooting myself in the foot, because of course Webb is the Alcantara. It just feels like the more likely guys in 450s they kind of don't have. They're going to be competitive. Webb can win a title any year he lines up. And again, this year we'll prove it. Probably next year we'll get to it and people will doubt him again. But it just, yeah, it feels like with 450, they're doing everything they can considering the circumstances. It is what it is. 250 is a little bit more, like I've kind of said before, like I feel like maybe they're riding the high too much of we have the best program, we can get this done with anybody, where I would argue, and it's not offensive to some of their riders, but outside of Hayden, I don't know if they really have 9 out of 10 to 10 out of 10 talents. I feel like it's a lot more like 7 and 8 out of 10 talents. And they're thinking the program's going to carry them that last little bit. The problem is like Levi's emerged, Tom the class, like there's legit 9 and 10 out of 10 competition on other teams and the bikes have caught up. So I don't, yeah, Hayden will probably win a title next year. I kind of don't have a strong feeling about anybody else on the team being that competitive in 250 Supercross for a title. the one we were talking about. Sorry. Yes, that should be good. But still, I don't. Yeah, I think it'll be a little bit business back to usual next year for 250s. But I still don't know how long that road is. Like that could end with one or two people leaving the team again. I don't know, you know, going forward, I recruiting wise, I kind of don't know what they're going to do. 450s, they're in a tough spot. Webb's going to do everything he can. Eli's going to do everything he can, but like a Jet or a Chase can be very hard to beat down the road. If Chase starts to figure out the KTM situation more and Jet just keeps building, that's tough. I feel like you know, Coop and Eli, considering their point in their career, they can keep doing it, but God, it's hard to expect those guys to keep leveling up.
Yeah, that's fair. And actually, funny, in the press conference when Jason Anderson was talking about the Coop incident, he said, so much respect for Coop. It's great to see him fighting for championships at his age. It's like, he's 28. Like,
he's younger than Jason.
He's not 37.
And we say this again about Chase at Coop, and I don't know if it's, I'm trying to decide if this is a smack to the face or if it's like the ultimate compliment, especially his Bass 450s win initially, and just again his style, his function on the bike, things like, I am so impressed that he keeps leveling up and keeps basically shutting people up. Is it wrong? Like I said, is that a backhanded compliment? I'm basically saying like, yeah, just none of us expect this from you and you somehow do it. Like, I don't know if that's a backhanded compliment or something really nice about saying like, look, you just didn't come across as, he was overlooked in amateurs, everything. Like, he just, something about him, he doesn't come across as a generational guy, and yet he's in those conversations.
Well, I'm scared to ask this because I was just going to ask it and I was like, maybe this is too far. When you look back in years to come, I feel as though Cooper's stock will only rise as time goes on.
Yeah.
Because then it will set in. And I would almost argue that you will look at Cooper Webb as hand in hand with Eli Tomac. Supercross wise.
Okay. Supercross wise, yes, we can have that conversation. Eli's win total is so high.
As I was saying it, I was like, okay, the win total may skew it, but
I agree in your sense. Okay, I'm not going to go quite that far, but I really think, I mean, look at what, I still think Coop is yes, I think he will be more highly regarded by the end of his career than he is in it. I think it'll be easier to look back at his accomplishments and appreciate what he did. And, you know, he still has more to go. Like, we'll see what keeps coming, but he's definitely somebody that should be more appreciated now, and I hope at the end of his career he's more appreciated, because each year goes on, I'm more and more like, god damn, this guy is impressive.
Yeah, and actually to that point, last week we discussed about the discussion about him being the best he's ever been, and he actually agreed and said this is the best version of himself. Even though he has now said that, I still, like, I'm not all the way there, because I still believe he has been so damn good in years gone by that this can only be equal to, it just can't be better, but he does believe this is the best version of himself. So
see, now that argument, when he said those words, because I think I said this last week and I argued, I don't know if this is the actual, compared to his competition at the time, I don't know if this is the best he has ridden. Like, I think of the some of the performances against Kenny, of course, and stuff. But I would agree in the sense, I think he's so full pet. Like, I think the impressive thing with him this year, again, we've talked about it, is the ability to change up how he won. It was just so unlike Coop. To watch him lead races wire to wire and control them, not have to, you know, just rely on waiting to the end. It's come out of necessity. Again, you look at Jet Lawrence, he will most likely never beat Jet Lawrence in the same way he used to win. He had to change that up. To see him carry his excellent race craft, weight cuts down low, he's got great fitness all races, but to just change up the way he's historically been the best at winning, to me, is super impressive.
Okay, final point, because I meant to say this last week and I forgot. Walking around the pits in Nashville, there was a fan, and maybe he's listening to this, who knows, but you know the little like pit boards you can write on?
Yeah.
He got one of those and wrote on it, Eli Tomac is better than you, and stood outside the HRC pit with it high above his head. And I walked past like a few times and he was still there. So I don't know how long he was stood there, but it was more than just like a 1 minute thing. And I meant to mention that last week for some reason. Not that it really adds anything at all, but you know, just.
I have a closing comment that makes me think of this, just like Eli coming back, what we have. Do you feel right now as a Supercross fan, like as a fan of the sport, a journalist covering it, do you feel like in a sense almost lucky that, you know, again, we've talked about these guys hanging in there, Webb continuing to level himself up, Eli, like it's so easy to just see the changing of the guard could have happened. This could be the Chase and Jet era clean cut, but there's got like, again, you have Kubi, like guys that are hanging and Kenny that are not quite okay with letting that happen. And I am, it's so much fun.
Yeah, because if you look at it, we could quite easily be in a situation now where the results from Philadelphia were Jet, Chase, Hunter, Malcolm, or throw Malcolm in that category. Jet, Chase, Hunter, Ferrandis, Cooper, Bloss, Nichols, AC. Like, there's a lot of guys that are right on the edge and could quite easily not be there right now.
Yeah.
actually really is just bummed me out reading that, like reading it like that.
Well, I was saying, I think you would have seen maybe some more 250 guys take their move earlier if you like some guys have definitely been apprehensive because of those spots. But again, okay, what you just said about Coop, we'll look back at him greater. Like, I feel like we have so many guys that are true, true legends of the sport. They're just still here. And it's, I think we're lucky to have it. And I'm grateful that we have it. We didn't just get the hard transition into Shea/into the Jet era. That these guys are willing to continue to put themselves out there another year or two and give us something enough where, you know, who knows, maybe like I said, maybe Jet just comes out and maybe this is the story, you know, as much as we all want to see continuous parity, maybe Jet latches, strangleholds the sport for 7 years, 10 years. Maybe he does. Maybe we get lucky and these guys kind of put up enough of a battle. Some other guys come along in the meantime and we get to continue this. That's, you know, we'll all have to wait and see though.
Yeah, it does feel like we are on a almost on like a knife's edge at the moment of like a big shift is coming and it could come tomorrow morning. You know, like you know, like it's literally any moment now it's coming. And we don't know what that looks like because it could be Jet domination, it could be Jet versus Chase, and like, but you know, who knows, maybe it'll end up being Jet versus Chase so equally matched that the next era will be actually even better because it will be like a James versus Chad era where these two are just not giving each other an inch. I think that's best case scenario, to be honest.
And I'm curious again, like there's the hopeful, like, okay, I think we both agree, like Levi could be something really good on a 450.
Yes.
Hayden, it's just the process of him taking a style to 450 is so interesting to me. I'm saying luckily we have stuff to keep kind of abide our time with these guys continuing to sign back up, but it's, you know, the future, there is hope that it could be more than Chase and Jet. At least, like I said, we have some of the old guard hanging around to get us there. Enough time to watch the next new guard come in and see if they can make this happen.
Yeah, it's and to come back to something that I've said over and over, it is also on us to like convey that this is not boring. Like it's on us to make people get excited about, like you say, Levi entering the 450s and whatever else, because it would be quite easy for even us to just fall into the trap of like, yep, it's going to be Jet and Chase in either first or second in some order for the next 15 years. And like, you know, so it's on us to try and be a bit of a hype machine, I guess, for the series. We'll speak to Feld and see if he'll pay us to do that. Right. Any final thoughts?
Nah, I think this has been a good one. We've had plenty to discuss. I'm good.
Thank you to Decal Works. Thank you to Beta. Thank you to Fox Racing for their support of this podcast show as per. Thank you to everyone for listening. Denver this weekend, it should be another great race. Of course, it will be quite an emotional round returning to the scene of the crime as it was regarding Eli's injury from last year. So yeah, a lot to unpack when gates drop in 6 days' time. In the meantime, stay tuned to Vital MX for a lot more content. Ducati story this week.
Ooh.
Pending approval. But yeah, so a lot more to come. So look out for that. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next week.